We have met the enemy, and he are us. When I first sent the sermon title to Carolyn Scott, she says, "Oh, no, 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 that's wrong. That's grammatically incorrect." And I said, "Yes, I know, but that's the way I've always heard it." So about a week later, she called and said, "Now, I've researched and I've looked at the Pogo comic strip." Back in the day, we called them the funny papers. And she said, "What Pogo said was, we have met the enemy and he is us," which is grammatically correct. So I said, "Well, Carolyn, I really don't care. This is the way I remember it. This is the way I remember it since I was a teenager, so I'm going with it." Now, until recently, I had always interpreted these words as we are our own worst enemy. And I think that's what Pogo had in mind. And now I'm not so sure. And this morning, I'd like to take a look at an alternate interpretation through the cacophonous, contentious, and cloudy lens of contemporary culture, namely religion, immigration, and race. From here on in, it no longer becomes humorous. First, religion. The Roman Catholicism of my teenage years preached that only Catholics could go to heaven and all others were destined to eternal damnation. The followers of John Calvin and John Knox taught that only their followers were destined to heaven, and only those that were predestined to heaven would be saved. All others were destined to eternal damnation. Jews have always taught that they, and only they, were the chosen people of God. The Quran of Islam teaches that paradise is for those who worshiped God alone, believed and followed their prophet, and lived moral lives according to the teachings of Scripture. And these are just a few examples of religions teaching the differences between believers and others. Now, immigration gets even tougher. Immigration to the United States became an issue around the middle of the 19th century. It is not a new issue. The United States government and citizens have historically opposed the immigration of others into our nation, whether they be Chinese coolies, Irish who were considered black, Italians, Puerto Ricans, ignoring the fact that they are citizens, Latinos from Central America and Mexico, Indians, Syrians, and on and on and on. So it is not just the present immigration issues that have plagued our country. We have a history. Finally, race. We have a worse history. 400 years ago, on February 12th, ironically, the date that Abraham Lincoln would be born, a shipload of Africans was placed into slavery in the Virginia colony. This was the beginning of one of the two worst elements of American history. Slavery was and is morally reprehensible, caused a civil war between portions of our country, and fostered disdain and persecution of people of African ancestry in this country. More than a century ago, a stretch of North Tulsa was dubbed the Black Wall Street for its booming black-owned businesses. Much of that prosperity was wiped out during one of the worst episodes of racial violence in America and in American history. In May 1921, a white mob set fire to hundreds of businesses and homes, killing as many as 300 people and scorching 40 blocks. This is just one of the many instances of violence and hatred against African Americans. Billie Holiday sang of strange fruit hanging from trees in response to lynchings, mainly in the South, but not entirely. After all, the KKK was founded in Indiana, hardly a Southern state. Today we have suppression of voting rights, racial profiling, whether overt or covert, police brutality, and laws with greater penalties for blacks than for whites. The other element of racial hatred was the treatment of Native Americans by the U.S. government and by white settlers, predominantly of Anglo-Saxon descent, who were greedy for land, minerals, buffalo hides, and blood. Eli Parker, who was the first commissioner of Indian Affairs and whose Iroquois name, Native American commissioner of Indian Affairs and whose Iroquois name was Donahogawa, wrote these following words. Although this country was once wholly inhabited by Indians, the tribes and many of them once powerful who occupied the countries now constituting the states east of the Mississippi have, one by one, been exterminated in their abortive attempts to stem the western march of civilization. If any tribe remonstrated against the violation of their natural and treaty rights, members of the tribe were inhumanly shot down and the whole treated as mere dogs. It is presumed that humanity dictated the original policy of the removal and concentration of the Indians in the West to save them from threatened extinction. But today, by reason of the immense augmentation of the American population and the extension of their settlements throughout the entire West, covering both slopes of the Rocky Mountains, the Indian races are more seriously threatened with a speedy extermination than ever before in the history of the country. Again, this is by Donahogawa, who was Commissioner of Indian Affairs under President Ulysses S. Grant. In a U.S. Senate hearing about the same time period, Senator John Logan said to Sitting Bull, "The government feeds and clothes and educates your children now and desires to teach you to become farmers and to civilize you and to make you as white men." So the assertion of whiteness, cultural superiority, is nothing new. On February 19, 1942, President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, yes, we had executive orders back then, to inter persons of Japanese descent, most of them U.S. citizens, in concentration camps. So many enemies. But are they? Our Jewish and Christian roots tell us, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. George Washington stated in 1783, "The bosom of America opens to receive not only the opulent and respectable stranger, but the oppressed, persecuted of all nations and religions." It's easy to see where Emma Lazarus got inspiration for the poem on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. James Madison, who was the driving force behind the U.S. Constitution, stated, "We are offering an asylum to the persecuted and oppressed of every nation and religion. The religion, then, of every man must be left to the conviction and conscience of every man, and it is the right of every man to exercise as these may dictate." Eboo Patel, who's a contemporary Pakistani-American writer, wrote of an interesting experience of his as a boy. He was invited to a birthday party, and his mother gave him two all-beef hot dogs to take so that he would have something to eat that wasn't made of pork, Patel being a Muslim. When he snuck into the kitchen to heat his hot dogs, he found that another boy had got there first with his beef hot dogs. He asked the boy who he was, and the boy replied, "Chaim, my mother made me bring beef hot dogs." Patel asked, "Are you Muslim?" To which the boy responded, "No, I'm Jewish." Patel continued, "I remember having two dominant thoughts at that time." And this is an 8-year-old kid. "This kid and me were going to be friends. And whatever Jewish was, I liked it." From that point on, when I met a Jew, Patel continues, "I assumed that we had similarities, and I assumed that these similarities had something to do with how we related to our respective religions." For me, the lesson of this story is simple. A particular environment made salient a commonality of faith between Chaim and me. A different environment may have elicited different expressions of our faith, expressions that could have highlighted divisions rather than resonances. And remember, it was the Muslim community who raised over $200,000 for the funeral expenses of those murdered at the Tree of Life Synagogue in the Squirrel Hill section of Pittsburgh. Adam Rutherford, the English geneticist, stated in his book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Lived, there are no essential genetic elements for any particular group of people who might be identified as a race. As far as genetics is concerned, race does not exist. In fact, he goes on to say that the rare cases of genetic differences show up more between Africans and other Africans than show up between Africans and Europeans. Isn't that interesting? So race must be a social construct, not a biological fact. And as a construct, it can be deconstructed. But it must be deconstructed on both the systemic front and in the hearts of individuals. And it is in the hearts of individuals that we speak of today. And to do that, we have to understand what is in their hearts as well. Rutherford wrote in his epilogue, writing this book has affected the way I think about people. I write these words sitting on a crowded London Underground train on the Victoria Line on a Wednesday morning in a sullen March. The train is crammed, and it's not particularly pleasant. Everyone is harassed about arriving at work on time, and we aren't prone to gracious behavior in these circumstances. W.E.B. Du Bois was much more direct and specific in his essay, Black Reconstruction in America, which was published in 1935. Back of the writhing, yelling, cruel-eyed demons who break, destroy, maim and lynch, and burn at the stake is a knot, large or small, of normal human beings, and these human beings at heart are desperately afraid of something. Of what? Of many things, but usually of losing their jobs, being declassed, degraded, or actually disgraced, of losing their hopes, their savings, their plans for their children, of the actual pangs of hunger, of dirt, of crime. Sound familiar? Du Bois describes very human emotions here. So when we are tempted to look down our morally superior, self-righteous UU noses at such people, people who may wear MAGA caps and chant, build the wall, remember that they are people just like us. They are human beings, and we must respect their inherent worth and dignity. Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Abraham Lincoln, in his first inaugural address, said, we are not enemies, but friends. He went on to say, the mystic chords of memory, when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Our universalist roots would deem it necessary to be touched by our better angels of universal inclusion. We have met the enemy, and he are us. And yes, sometimes we are our own worst enemy. But more importantly, those we perceive as our enemy are just like us. In fact, they are us. 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 So let it be, and let it be us.